Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Ethics Talk. My name is Hope May, and I'm joined tonight by Erica Maley.
Hello.
And Rebecca Woodkey.
Hello.
And also on the line with us, hopefully for quite a bit of the show, is Nicholas Brousseau.
Hello.
And so tonight's show is a continuation of last week's show. We've been talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, in particular Article 26, and even more specific, Section 2 of Article 26, which we have been calling the Development Clause. And I will read that section again. It says, "Education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality and to the strengthening and respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms." And so once again, we're focused on this clause before the "and." Education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality. And we are going to try to understand the connection between this clause, the development clause, and also Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which basically says something like, all human beings are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood. So we're exploring this connection about the relationship between the development of the human personality and reason and conscience. We had a very good discussion last week, and so I'm going to turn it over to Rebecca to recap as best as we can what we started talking about last week. So, Rebecca?
Right. So this week we're going to focus on the correlation between Article 26 and Article 1, whereas last week we focused on the conflict that can arise in Article 3, which states everyone has the right to life, liberty, and the security of the person. And we discussed whether or not Article 26, which states education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality, can come into conflict with Article 3. The conclusion that I've kind of made is that no, they do not conflict, because actually education is a means of expressing liberty. Once through education, the personality can become fully developed, which allows a person to further express liberty and fully develop their own liberty. Now, I don't know if everyone agrees with that, which brought us into some discussions of positive and negative rights. Remember, positive rights, those are rights that someone else has a duty to provide, and negative rights is a right for someone else not to interfere with those rights.
Mm-hmm.
So these are both both important rights, and again, don't get confused with the connotation. But we did come up with, I think, one agreement from last week's conversation, which was reason and emotion are critical to the development of personality. Now, whether or not education is critical to the development of personality,
mm-hmm.
I think can be argued.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, it's all coming back to me now, but we had this discussion about, you know, what education is, and is it this sort of formal procedure that we're used to where you go to a school and you sit in a class, and the question is, you know, is that the kind of thing, is that mode necessary for this development of liberty, or is there something else? And then we all also were talking about who is sort of responsible for this education. And there was, you know, some discussion about whether or not the government and public education is the best safeguard of developing liberty, if I recall.
Right. I think we often think of education in a very traditional sense, but I think the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it is written in an ambiguous way,
mm-hmm.
where there is an interpretation of what education can mean. And according to the Declaration, and as we kind of discussed in last week's episode, kind of came to the conclusion that education is directed to the full development of the human personality. That is the sole purpose mm-hmm. of education, and how it goes about doing that can vary.
Yeah, and I also am reminded of the discussion that we had about the internet, and our friend Joe called in and it said something like, before the internet, he was dumb, or something like this. And, you know, all of the information on the, as it is now, free internet, I think is, you know, extremely valuable. And the word I think we used last week was autodidactic, so like a self-learner, someone who's motivated to teach themselves things, can really find a gold mine in the internet and does not necessarily have to go through the formal channels of education. Nick, do you have anything to say about this? Because I know that you have some thoughts about education.
I guess I'm still hung up on just, what the education's all about. So going back to who provides this education and who defines it, I mean, if it's loosely defined and therefore it's got a lot of room to find itself as education, you know, to take a drastic kind of side of things, well, there could be an education that supports, you know, things that are harmful towards other humans or encourages certain prejudices towards certain races. And so these kind of things that we would consider very negative and harmful towards the human race and in the kind of anti-liberty or anti-freedom for some individuals, which would be encouraged by education. So I guess I find education such a broad term that it's kind of scary in that result, but it's also cool to see that that word or that concept is at least being articulated as something that's important, that we understand we need to encourage the human faculties. But in one sense, we do this is, you know, really, really crucial. And as you were pointing out about the kind of autodidactic person, I think what, you know, education would ultimately create is those types of people who were actualized to the point where they could take on whatever pursuit that they desired. So those are just kind of my immediate thoughts on them. I don't know how radical my idea of education is or if it fits in with the idea of liberty or would violate the liberty clause, which I believe you said was in Article 3. It seems that it could if you were to think of education as this damaging part to the human liberty, then it would no longer fall under education, right? Or it would violate another part of it, of the clause, and therefore not be allowed.
Right, and to answer your concern of it violating other human rights, actually, Article 26, we were just looking at the first clause, but it continues to say, and to the strength, education shall be directed to the full development of the personality and to the strengthening of respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. It shall promote understanding, tolerance, and friendship among all nations, racial or religious groups, and shall further the activities of the United Nations for the maintenance of peace. So if we stick with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the radical view of education I don't think needs to be... I mean,
right.
That's a good point
that's
to bring
pretty,
up,
okay.
But
well, I'm glad that was okay. Cool, got that clarified.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. I'm glad they put that in there. That's huge.
So, I think your point about you know, education should be aimed at sort of cultivating someone to be a lover of learning or someone who's autodidactic. I like to maybe use this point as a transitional point. Do you want to take that, Rebecca?
I think that the autodidactic really comes in with the human personality. Not everybody's going to be motivated to search the internet to learn these things, and other people will be very motivated and will see this as a tool to be cultivated and to be used.
Do you think, though, that people who are not currently motivated to use the internet to, you know, learn about things can be educated or awakened in a way that they do use the internet in that way? I think that's what you were saying, Nick. Am I understanding you correctly?
I think so, yeah.
Well, I think the internet just makes information a lot more easily accessible, but the information has always been there, and there's always been venues to
mm-hmm.
gather that information.
Mm-hmm.
But it's for those who are motivated, it's such a wonderful tool,
mm-hmm.
but I'm not sure how big of an impact it has on those who
mm-hmm.
are not motivated.
So, Nick, do you have ideas about how you would use education to cultivate this autodidactic personality?
Well, I'd have to stop before the autodidactic person and say just because somebody's autodidactic doesn't mean that they're a good human being or good for the human race. In fact, somebody who's, I've once heard it described, you know, a bumbling Gandhi who, you know, isn't really able to get anything done, but he's a really nice person, that's kind of cool, you know, whatever. You know, he doesn't need to be super smart to be a nice guy. Whereas if you have, like, a really intelligent Hitler, you know, an autodidactic Hitler, it's a much more frightening thing. So there's some sort of moral development that comes with learning, I guess, or with an autodidactic, needs to be paired up with an autodidactic person that has to do with some sort of morality, where morality takes over, it starts to get pretty tricky on how to cultivate such a person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know.
Yeah,
I don't know if
like,
I segue into a different thing.
No, actually, like this is the conclusion of last week's show, which was that reason and emotion and emotional intelligence, which is the kind of, I mean, I think you're using the phrase, you know, moral, but the sort of emotional intelligence and concern for other people, that is just as important as the cultivation of the intellect. So whatever the human personality looks like, its development actually is acknowledging the cultivation of both of those parts of the person.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I think one thing that I was just thinking about that's kind of interesting when you think about, like, in order, like, if people are going to be, how do you say it?
Autodidactic.
Autodidactic. It's, like, important to for them to have, like, a good moral compass that, like, leads them to use, like, those skills and that motivation in the right way. But then it's also interesting because it's, like, where do you learn your morals? And I learn them from, like, other people and things that I see and evaluate. And so it's just, it's, I don't know, I was just interested in how, like, it's taught, sort of, but it's also just, like, you're socialized to it. So it all kind of depends on, like, your environment. And it's also something, too, like if other people were taught it before you and then the people before them were taught these morals, like, where did it really come from?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, when I think of the development of moral behavior or character, I like to use that word, I'll agree that, you know, the sort of data comes from the outside and you see people and you say, I want to be like that. And you see people exhibiting certain character traits. I want to have that character trait. And as everybody basically knows, I'm an Aristotelian. And so what Aristotle says is, you know, if you want to develop the character trait, you have to actually practice the activities that lead to the character trait. I'm fond of quoting this line from Three Kings. It's a movie, George Clooney is in it, and at some point in the movie, George Clooney says, he's a soldier in the Iraq War, and the first Iraq War, and he says something like, here's the thing, and he's talking to one of his buddies who's also in the army, and he says, here's the thing, you do the thing that you're scared of, and then you get the courage. And his friend goes, you know, that's just backwards. And he goes, I know, but that's how it works. My father also would say, do the things you fear, and the fear will disappear. And so there's that. At that point, it becomes you. So in other words, you see that there are these people who are exhibiting this behavior, and then you're faced with a moment in your life, and you say, okay, like now is the time that I can practice courage. And at that point, in my view, it's a personal decision, and you're the one who's in control of whether you say, okay, go for it, or no, I can't do it. So for me, it does come down to the sort of voice in your head, if you will, that you choose, and Aristotle, I think, says the same thing, that you choose to listen. He says you choose to listen to the rule. And in that sense, it's you. So it's a combination of the data is coming from outside, but you're deciding what to do with the data, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I guess it's like you take it into your own hands, like what you want to do. Like you have this knowledge, but kind of like how I said, like a lot of these, I mean, most people are socialized so that we have a lot of similar or the same morals. Mm-hmm. And so I guess what makes us different then is how internally, if we decide to do something,
yeah,
and how we react.
And I'm struck by, you know, recently I went to, you were there at the Assembly of States parties in New York, but I don't think you were in this session with me. I think you had left.
Okay.
But President Song, he's the president of the International Criminal Court, was talking about, and he's a judge, and he was talking about how he sort of looked around and saw that nobody was really educating other states about complementarity, and that this was something, and I'll just spare you as to what that even means, but just the short version is there was like something that needed to be taught to people, and Judge Song saw that it was not being taught to people, and he took it upon himself to do it. And in this talk, he was like, you know, this is uncharacteristic for a judge to take up this kind of political advocacy role and work with states and so forth. Like, the judge is supposed to be behind the bench in their roles. He's, like, out in the field working with people. And, like, that's also something that has to do with the development of character, because I think, going back to what you said, at each point there's someone who, in their station of life, realizes certain things are not being done. And again, to quote Rabbi Hillel, if not now, when? If not me, who? Like, I'm the one who has to do it because I'm seeing it. And there's a sort of creative act that goes on with that as well. And so I think a lot of progress in the world happens when you have such people recognizing a need. Nobody who should be filling it is filling it, and then they go to fill. And I think that character and morality are developed in that way as well. Anyone?
It seems that is the case. And when we're talking about the human being, we have an incredibly diverse amount of people with different faculties, right, and also different social experiences. And so as a result, like, I don't know, you can imagine a child that wasn't held when they were a baby, and as a result, developmentally, they're not the same, that, you know, they're basically don't have any trust for anyone. Or you can think of any myriad of situations that the human being encounters that has some sort of damaging effect on the faculties. And when we speak about education and, you know, talking about people having that kind of free will, I'm just wondering, I guess, or posing the question, does free will still account for people who don't have that support of a social environment, or, say, even a country who doesn't have much of a history of, say, you know, social tolerance? Where does that come from? And does it come from just other people, like you said, that kind of fulfill this void and represent kind of the lighthouse of where to kind of lead people? Is that kind of what you're presenting, I guess, then, by the individual who fulfills some need? Did that make sense?
Yes, it does. Does anybody want to take that one?
I think so morals can be established within personality. And personality is something that you're not completely born with, but that extrinsic activities alter? And the same would go for morals then too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, talking about potential or capacity, you know, I've been studying, you know, genocide lately, and everybody says every human being has the capacity for this. Let's hope it's not actualized, right? And so, yeah, we have the capacity to be evil. We have the capacity to be, you know, beautiful and wonderful to people. So there are all these capacities that we have, and so the moral faculties, if you will, are things that need to be developed and honed.
So then it would be dependent on someone's experience, someone's upbringing, someone's culture surroundings on the morals that they subsequently develop.
Well, I think that's one of the questions that Nick is asking. I mean, to some extent, yeah, like other people and ideas. I mean, just think of like the data, you know, has to come from somewhere. But is that all of it? And I think Nick's question is about sort of like this free will and what's responsible. If I'm understanding your question wrongly, Nick, please correct me. But I think your question is for these people who are able to be the beacon, as you said, what's going on there? And like, did that come from their upbringing, or is there something in them that that they turned on? Is that your question?
Well, I guess now that you kind of articulated my question, it seems like there's two parts. So the one part is, do the people that have these bad or negative or bad, we'll use the word bad, I guess, bad cultural surroundings full of excess and bad things, are they able to be brought out by this kind of education, which is this light in the storm, or which is this lighthouse kind of beacon thing? And that person that is that beacon, or that educational institution that is that beacon, did that come from just having the right upbringing, or was there something internal to that individual that, yeah. So I guess the first question seems more important than the second.
Okay, but either of you want to take that?
I think like anything, it's a combination of nature and nurture. So this person can be in this hostile environment and then, but have intrinsic motivation. So that would be possibly the nature of them to learn more, to do better. And then they're then exposed to this other extrinsic, which would be like the beacon. And they can then change their path to that subsequent one. So they
does your model then also take the kind of opposing form where there's a nature that is inherently bad, where there's an inherent kind of evil, malice?
I like to live the idealized. Everybody is innately good, but...
Well, I think there's room for the malice, right? And we can have an idealistic view of human nature. I tend to kind of look at each human being in that idealistic view. I think it's the best way to do it. Otherwise, I'm categorizing somebody in a really bad way and encouraging them to be that way as a result of that projection. But that said, if the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and, everyone else is kind of getting it and going to the beacon, and this other person's like, no, check out this darkness. It's gnarly and cool. So they're going to the darkness. There's a level at which human compassion and human empathy and that beacon actually grows as a result of that malice, right? Because if you can still find love and compassion for something that's really evil and foreign to your own nature, doesn't that really shine out the human spirit and really bring kind of the whole thing back to the really, I guess, some sort of concrete, true, good, beautiful stuff?
Yeah, I hear you.
Cool.
Definitely. You mean so when the beacon responds to the evil with love and compassion, that makes the beacon shine all the more? Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. To be super cheap all about it, yeah.
Yeah. I just, when you say that, I think of Socrates, you know, because he was subjected to a lot of evil around him, and he just, you know, stayed the course with what his conscience and reason told him to do, you know, using the language of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And that beacon is still shining, you know, over 2,000 years later, we're still talking about him. And so, yeah, so actually I'll just read you this quote from my mug on my desk, which is from A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and I think it captures what you're saying. We have a tendency, this is me talking, not the quote, but we have a tendency when, like, the evil person is in our life to say, that person's an a-hole and get away from me. But here's what the quote on my mug says. This is section 107 from The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, and a chapter on patience. It says, therefore, since my adversary assists me in my bodhisattva way of life, I should long for him like a treasure discovered in the house and acquired without effort. Thus, he and I have obtained the fruit of patience. It should be given to him first, for patience is caused by him. Yeah, like, the point being, like the quote-unquote evil person is actually a treasure that enables us to really practice our beaconhood. And so
we should be
grateful for that person. Yeah, you know, love it.
An interesting way of looking at things.
It's an old way of looking at things. Go ahead, Arka.
Well, I think this is kind of like at the most simple way of saying it. It kind of relates to how people say, like, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Like, if a person is going to challenge you and kind of, like, it makes you, like, be better at, like, what you are and, like, what you're doing and what you're pursuing. Like, you shine brighter. Because,
I love it.
Yeah, you're challenged.
Yeah, and to connect it with this, we are talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and if you don't realize it, you need to strive harder, because we're definitely talking about it. And last week, as we said, the sort of main conclusion that we wrapped up with was that this full development of the human personality, which the UDHR mentions as the sort of aim of education, or one of the aims, at the very least, you know, what's important to it is this development of reason and emotion. And Joe used the term EQ, emotional quotient, which is from this book, Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goleman. Excellent book. But, you know, this, I think this is what we're talking about, this quote that I just read from the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. Like, that is emotional intelligence when you're around, you know, the evil person, and you can actually control your emotions and not be freaked out by the evil and so forth, but, like, look at that person from love and compassion. That is what Goleman talks about in emotional intelligence. He mentions this story. I wish I had it with me, but I'll just try to work from memory, where, I don't know, people were on a bus, and somebody got onto a bus, and he was just, you know, yelling at everybody, and he was being, you know, an a-hole, and he was, you know, sort of shoving people, and people were getting really pissed off, and there was somebody on the bus who knew some sort of martial art, and he was getting ready to, you know, use his craft on this guy on the bus who's disrupting everyone, and there was also on the bus, like, an old man, and the old man sort of smiled at the guy who was being a jerk and said, you know, come sit with me. What's wrong? It was just really calm and loving. And in fact, the guy had been suffering some sort of thing, and it was, you know, it made sense why he was acting out. And Daniel Goleman says, like, this is what, quote, emotional brilliance is. To be in the face of somebody who really is testing your anger, and then to control it and respond with love and understanding. He does call that emotional brilliance. It's in the beginning, I think, of the book. But, yeah, so maybe this is what we mean by you know, emotional intelligence, and that's what Joe meant last week.
I think to be emotionally brilliant, you have to take some part of passion out and use your logic and reason more so. Because if the man would have acted out of passion, he would have, his emotions could have been high and angry and wrapped up in what this other man was doing and how he was being so rude, and you just get passionate about this event and overlook the logic and reason of why he's acting this way.
Yeah, do either of you want to respond? Go ahead.
Have you ever had the experience where you found something like absolutely hilarious, and as a result, for some reason, whether it was just the situation called for it or whatever, you remain calm, but inside you're like, man, that is hysterical, like, and you're just inside just calm. Has anyone been put to that test and done that as a result?
I just laugh out loud.
I have bad social skills that way. You know, I do too. I'm not saying that it's a bad thing to do. I'm just questioning to kind of bring it to a more concrete example. I mean, we can talk about reason and emotions, but to talk about the practical experience of it, I think is something more along the lines of like when you're experiencing extreme elation or joy, or when you're experiencing extreme sorrow or anger, to still remain an inner calm. So it's like you can be conscious that such emotions are taking place, but as I think it was Rebecca that was saying, that you like kind of go towards your reason or your logic or something. I don't know if I would necessarily call it reason or logic. I think it still might be, as you said, kind of with the emotions, emotional intelligence, where you're able to experience an emotion and still remain inwardly calm. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I've recently been trying to practice this skill quite often, because I find myself in a scenario where I need to practice these things. But the ability to remain calm when angry, or the ability to remain calm when really excited, and not to say that you don't experience it, but just that your actions depict calm, and you like are inwardly calm. I don't know how else to describe it.
And when you say that you're practicing this, just to bring it back to this description of this as like you're using reason and logic in this scenario, what comes to me is it's you're like the inner voice is activated, right? Like, calm down. This guy obviously has an issue. You know, remember your mantra. Or remember, like, section 107 of the Bodhisattva. So there's like, the voice that comes to you, and it's not just this raw emotion. And so, you know, it's the logos, it's the word in your head. And if you want to call that reason and logic, that's fine. But for me, and my question for you, Nick, is when you say that you're practicing this, is that what you're doing? I mean, is there sort of a voice in your head that, you know, you're listening to, or is there no language whatsoever in this practice? Or are you focusing on something in your visual field? What is this practicing consist in?
Well, you know, I think it's cool because it's afforded in all our lives, and I definitely think that life has its way of presenting kind of moments of extreme elation or moments of extreme sorrow, and the ability, I think, is to not let your thoughts. So I guess it is a voice, but it's more of an experience of thoughts. And I don't personally, I'm not saying it's not the right way to go about it, but I don't personally go to some quote or to something. I concentrate on, okay, so what am I thinking at this moment? Like, am I thinking like, dude, you're being a total a-hole, you know? Or am I thinking like, wow, so like, why is that happening? Or am I thinking like, oh, you know, it'd be cool to be on a beach right now. So in developing kind of just where your thoughts go. I think your internal experience largely makes up who you are and what you're about. And so it's kind of a control of your thoughts. It's focusing your attention on the right things. And what those right things are depend completely on your situation and are unique to you. They're almost intuitive, right? Because it's not as if you're always going to have the choice to make, like, to choose the best thing to think about. But you can, potentially. But these thoughts are weird things. They come from, you know, who knows, somewhere in the depths. But what thoughts you actually give power to through thinking them is, I think, what makes up that experience of either the emotional stupidity or the emotional intelligence.
So you're like directing, so there may be a whole menu of words, phrases, thoughts that come to you, and then you choose what to focus your attention on?
Yeah, I would say that's a good way of doing it. I tend to always just go to kind of like the agape, thinking about how that person's like cultivating something in me. Like you said, like, you know, they cultivate the patience. So maybe it is just a voice, and you go to a particular thing. Maybe I'm just trying to make it sound more majestic than that.
Cool. So now that we have gone down this labyrinth, let's see if we can agree on a proposition like we did last week. And so are we in agreement that what we're talking about and what Nick brought up is, like when we were talking about cultivating emotion and educating emotion and EQ, that this is the kind of thing that's involved?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good. So we agree. So let's go back to reason then, because the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, okay, so like, again, it's this phrase personality, and so far we've established that, okay, emotion is involved, and to develop that is to do the kind of thing that we have been talking about where you're maybe faced with some extreme emotional experience and you can sort of calm yourself down through paying attention to certain contents of your mind or things in your environment or so forth. So it says, endowed with reason and conscience, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights and are endowed with reason and conscience. Okay, just to remind you of the reason clause in Article 1. And then Article 26, once again, education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality. So let's talk about the reason aspect of the human personality. We've just talked about the emotion aspect. And to start us out, I just want to make this very important distinction between theoretical and practical reason, which is a distinction that we get in Aristotle, where theoretical reasoning is, it's the type of rational activity that most college students engage in when they're doing homework. So, you know, like reading, maybe studying for an exam, you're memorizing stuff and who said what about what and what are professor rights, what are the 16 different desires he thinks the human personality consists in, and this sort of like memorization of data, the use of reason. That's what we're calling theoretical reason. Practical reason is the type of rational activity involved in setting and realizing goals. And these goals could be very long-term. They could be very short-term. But when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that we are endowed with reason, I would say it's important for us to distinguish between these two different types of reason, theoretical and practical. And do either of you want to comment on this distinction?
Right. So when the UDHR says that we are endowed with reason, I would assume that to be the practical reason, because how can one be endowed with theoretical reason if they haven't?
Well, I mean, it could be that we're endowed with the potential for it. Because I would say we're not even... True, we're endowed with practical reasoning, and even babies have certain goals. They want food, so they cry, things like this. So in any case, yeah, I think it's unclear. And so what you're suggesting is it makes if we're going to be endowed with anything, it makes sense to say that we're endowed with practical reason. But once again, refer back to Aristotle.
Right.
He does say that this theoretical reasoning, and it's really the development of concepts and universals, does happen quite naturally, that this is just something that happens through language, and certain concepts will appear in our mind just completely naturally. So there could be this innate ability that we have that just comes with the development of the organism, right? Like babies don't have it, but when you have like an adolescent or something, they can engage in discussion which makes use of general terms. So what I'm saying is like there's the particular object, like the cat or this furry thing in front of me, and then there's the general idea, cat. And so when children are learning language, the parent or whomever is pointing to some particular in their visual field, and the child sees the brown furry panting and then hears the word cat, and then the child sees another brown furry panting and says cat, and the parent says no, dog. Right? And so over time, the child is able to actually come to this sort of universal, just through natural development. And that could also be referred to here. But I think it's a good point that you're making.
Well, I think, like, from what Rebecca and you said, Hope, like, I think another reason, yeah, why, like, you're endowed with the practical, like, that's what they're talking about, probably, and not the theoretical, is because, like, when we're talking about education, like, even a person that would be considered by most to be uneducated in, like, formal education still has practical reasoning for a lot of stuff, so.
And so the question is, does practical reason need to be educated? I mean, it's true that we have this ability.
Mm-hmm.
But as I was saying before the show, I know many people who have the ability to set goals, but their ability to realize them is really bad. And so I know, like, well, if their goal is this, why are they doing that? It makes no sense. Do you know such people?
Yes. Yeah.
Nick, and also I see that you dropped in your back, just so you know that you're back online, Nick.
Oh, cool. Yep. I realized that, yep.
Okay, so...
I know people like that.
Yeah, I think we all do. And there are some people who have no goals whatsoever.
Now, is that reason, though?
Well, I mean...
Or could that just be motivation?
Well, I mean, practical reasoning is the ability to set a goal and realize it. So setting goal is like a component of practical reasoning.
Okay.
Now, motivation, well, now you're talking about, okay, so if I've set a goal, I need to realize it. Of course, motivation is necessary for that. And so Aristotle would refer to that sort of suite of skills, suite, not S-W-E-E-T, but S-U-I-T-E. This collection of skills he calls phronesis, which is practical wisdom, which is sort of like this excellent ability to set a goal and realize it. Like the person has the chops. And it's a whole host of things. It's motivational. It's deliberative. It's emotional. So it's not just, you know, purely intellectual or rational in the way that we're used to thinking about it. So my point is that although we may all be endowed with this practical reasoning, I still think some sort of, like, education or cultivation is necessary given the fact that we all know people who are not very good at it. And I'm not saying that I'm good at it. I have my own problems of motivation.
I think cultivation is a better word for it than education.
Hmm.
Just because, like, I don't know, I just I keep having this, like, weird vision of, like, a village in Africa or something, and you're not going to school, but, like, you have, like, a mentor, like, an older person that's, like, helping you, like, realize, like, what your purpose here is and, like, what you're doing, you know? I don't know why I keep thinking of that, for
example.
Can
that be defined as education? It's not what you typically think, but...
I guess it'd be education, but, like, cultivation just, to me, seems like a better descriptor for it, because in that situation, it's not, like...
Formalized?
Yeah, and it's not, like, telling you,
exactly like how things are done or how you can go about it. It's more like guiding you if you need help.
Well, I'll just quote the language again from the development clause of Article 26. I know, education shall be directed to the full development of the human personality. So one question is that are you comfortable thinking about this sort of cultivation of practical reasoning as on the way to full development? Is that a more comfortable language for you?
Yeah.
It's just that, like, education shall be directed. So, it's the narrowness of education that you have a problem with.
Yeah, I guess so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is. I think in my mind it's a little bit more narrow than
okay. Cultivation.
Cool.
Anyone else?
Well, I think I like that the semantics are being argued there a little bit, and cultivation seems to ring a little bit more true in its broadness. But at the same time, when you say cultivation, then all of a sudden it's like, well, then there's no formality to it, right? So as a result, then education is everywhere, and so as a result, there's no, as the clause intends, I think, support system to encourage the sort of nourishment of the personality of the human, the full human personality.
But isn't the support system provided by the very goals of the cultivation? So, in other words, isn't it enough that I say cultivation shall be directed to the full development of the human personality and to the strengthening and respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms? So knowing that these are my goals, don't those goals sort of imply a whole system by their very nature? Does that make sense?
No. It depends on how you define system. Are you thinking of system as institution, as place where you go?
I'm saying like these words. Full development of the human here's my goals. Full development of the human personality, strengthening and respect for human rights and fundamental freedoms. Those words mean something, that there are certain restrictions, there are certain things that are incompatible with those goals, certain activities that are incompatible with those goals. That's
right.
All I'm saying. So there is like a limitation put on the cultivation by those words. So it's not like a total free-for-all is all I'm saying. Like, you're suggesting it's a total free-for-all. Am I making sense?
I think you're making sense. I think we're kind of caught up in some semantics that aren't really super relevant towards what I think the goal of what we're talking about was. And I would kind of like to get back towards the, maybe it is. I don't mean to dictate which way the conversation goes if we want to spend more time on that.
Direct.
The point you were bringing up about the goal setting thing and kind of how is that established, where does that come from, what's that about, and should that be a part of education or cultivation, however we want to say it, I think that's a really difficult question and a really good one. And I think, it really brings me to Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, that something fundamental to a human being is their purpose, right? And so, what reason do you have not to kill yourself right now? Like, although it seems like a pretty absurd question to a lot of us, it's really not, given that, we could not have a lot of the things that we perhaps have now, and would life still be worth living then? And so what is it that really motivates us? What is that pushes us onward to continue on with life and be in the development of ourselves, to even care about it? Because I think that's really the foundation of the full capacity of the human being, is contained in that fundamental starting point of what purpose do I have? What do I do? What makes up me?
I completely agree with that, and I think that purpose is really what can drive, that it serves as an intrinsic motivation to attain those goals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those that motivation is established through what internally drives you, I guess.
Yeah, and I would like to take this opportunity to, with 10 minutes left, to shift to the topic of solitude, because we've been trying to talk about this for the past 2 weeks, and I'm like, I'm claiming the last 10 minutes. So, Nick, awesome. Your question of how do we develop this cultivation of the practical reasoning, and I'm going to say that, and we've talked about this before the show, that this sort of like private activity and solitude is necessary for this development. So, Nick, your question is how? And I don't know the whole answer, but I will stab out and say one thing necessary, like one ingredient to make the cake, if you will, is solitude. And Erica, I was wondering if you could talk about that and how, because recently Erica achieved a huge goal of applying for a Truman Scholarship, which is like a Herculean, intense goal. And I know that solitude played a role in that attainment of the goal.
Mm-hmm.
And could you talk about that?
Sure. Well, I think before, like even deciding to apply for the Truman or that was a goal, like I had, like that was something that I had like heard about, but that was something that like on my own, like in my own thoughts by myself, it was something that I realized like I need to do this, like I want to do this and I have to find a way to do it. And then like the biggest part about being by yourself and like achieving this goal that I can relate to is like the actual application process, because the application is really extensive and it's not, I mean, it has the usual questions for an application where they ask you, you know, what have you done or list these things, but the majority of it are these essays that are involve like a lot of thought about why are you doing this and like what are you going to be doing with your life in 4 years and what are you going to be doing with your life in 5 to 7 years and what is your ultimate goal in life, and nobody can give you these answers because only you know, but you don't even know that you know until you give yourself the chance to like really really think about it. And one of the things that I told Hope about was like when it was coming, like it was go time. Like I had to work on my application. I had a few days left, and like I was sitting in my apartment kitchen by myself. None of my roommates were there. Like no TVs were on, no music. Like my computer was closed, and like I just had to like think about these things and like write it out and be by myself, because even the smallest distraction takes you away from seeing these, like, bigger pictures that you only get from being by yourself.
Mm.
So I could ramble on forever about this.
Please do.
Yeah, but, like, and I don't know, another thing that I kind of told Hope about and that I think other people would experience this if they like took the time to be by themselves is like, for me it was kind of scary because one, like I had thought about these things a little bit before, but I hadn't thought about them that much, and so it's just, I guess it's not that it's scary, it's just like wow, like overwhelming at first to really think about things in such like a large scale and like the big picture. But it's really rewarding at the same time because you have something that most people don't have. Like, I feel confident that most people don't have a vision of what their life is going to be to the extent that I have. I mean, before I did this application, I knew, like, you know, I want to work on human rights, or I want to work in international relations. But, like, now I really know what I want and, like, how, and I see different ways for me to accomplish this. And it doesn't mean that I have one set way that I'm going to do this because nothing, like, ever goes to plan, which the Truman is, like, a case in point because there were multiple times where I just, it was really hard. Like, there were things that didn't go or I made a mistake and I had, like, I just had to, like, force myself to work to overcome it. But, like, it's just, I know now.
Mm.
And without doing that and being by myself, I wouldn't know.
Mm. Cool. So, yeah, this sort of solitude is necessary for you to... I like what you said when you said, these goals were already in you, but you didn't know that they were in you until you made yourself sit down and think about them. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's like everybody has the potential to realize what their ultimate goals are, but in order to unearth them, it takes... time, labor, solitude, and these things don't have a good PR campaign in our culture.
No.
And like, kind of going, like, one more thing.
Please.
It's like how I said, like how you said it's like a labor, like you have to work at it, and how I said it's kind of overwhelming and scary. Like, it's easy to, like, put out a list of, like, this is what I'm going to do for the day, or this is what I'm going to do for the year, or this is what I'm going to do, but, like, for my life, but, like, to really think about, like, why, like, why am I going to do that, and, like, how is that going to help you realize, like, your goals, like, kind of how you were talking about earlier, how people, like, are doing things that don't relate to what they really want to achieve and stuff. It's just, like, that's, like, exhausting. And so people, like, thinking about these things, like, mentally for me, like, it wore me out. Like, at the end of it, I was like, I can't think about anything else. I just need to not think for a minute. But, like, once you take a step back and then you look at how much, like, you've grown, like, from thinking about this stuff, like, you realize how valuable it is for everybody else. And then, but you also realize why a lot of people probably wouldn't do it, because, like, it's exhausting to think about it, you know? But rewarding. Do it.
Yeah, and then once again, to quote Aristotle, whatever happiness is, it's something that can only be obtained with a lot of work. And he said something like, if happiness was just mere amusement, that would make no sense whatsoever. It can't just be being amused. It has to be something that is only acquired with effort and, he says, study. So, do you want to say something, Rebecca?
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think there's a lot of merit in solitude and in figuring out things for yourself, because each individual is that an individual. We focus a lot on human nature and what unites us, but there is value in recognizing that the individual is unique and has had experience that no other individual has had, and has thus comprised their personality and their motivation. And to realize that, I think, is a big accomplishment and very important to have a fulfilling, happy life.
Mm-hmm. Nick, do you have anything to say about this bit?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a worthwhile activity to take time to really think about the development of where you want to take your life. And I'm so sorry, I forget the name of the one who was applying for the Truman Scholarship I was speaking.
Erica.
Yeah, I really like the way, you know, and perhaps this is because, you know, perhaps it can be perceived as a negative, but the way that you said, not to say that, you know, I know exactly the way that the goals I established are going to manifest themselves, like, oh, I'm going to go to this college, I'm going to get this job, I'm going to do this thing and that thing. You didn't establish it like that. And so what I kind of got from the picture that you were establishing was that there's some sort of value that was discovered within you, that you were really following something that was internal, right? Something that your whole life, your whole crew of experiences kind of culminated, and you took the time in solitude to kind of bring those together and establish a value to guide or dictate where you were going to take yourself for the next 10 years. And again, I mean, those types of things then all of a sudden can really impact daily life and make those kind of experiences that may seem boring or perhaps, you know, just kind of are lagging on and taking a lot of time, that effort all becomes worth it because all of a sudden you understand that your life revolves around a value, around something that's not a material, you know, it's not a piece of paper, it's not a prestige or an honor, it's something very personal to you. And as a result, I think that, you know, comes towards what we would call authenticity or what some people would perhaps call authenticity. At least that's where I would kind of lean towards. And so bravo for taking the time to do that when you could have been off, you know, living the college dream, in quotes, you know, drinking beers and doing whatever. So bravo.
Thank you.
And I must say that as a person of solitude, I am. I live, you know, off the grid without electricity and, you know, up on 80 acres on a hill where there's not many of anything around. So that's, solitude's pretty cool. I would definitely say I've learned a lot about myself experiencing kind of getting away from the mass of kind of information and things going on. And I get a lot of time and I feel very lucky for this to be in solitude and to think.
Yeah, it's a great thing. Well, on that note, I think it's a good way to end the show, and I think perhaps maybe next week we can maybe delve into Elizabeth Cady Stanton's The Solitude of Self, because that's what we were sort of dancing around. But, Nick, it was so great to have you on the show. We hope you call back again, you know, if your car should break down somewhere this time or whatever it is. please, you know, participate.
Yeah, Erica, Rebecca, Hope, thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure to engage in this conversation, and I'm really happy that I was able to do so. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Likewise. All right, well, you've been listening to Ethics Talk. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody, and good night.
Good night.